You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining the plenary session on public pensions. We have assembled a celebrity cast in the pension world. We have three papers. It's a slightly different format than some of the other panels. Each panelist will present their papers in sequence. And then we have two discussants that alternatively are going to ask questions, show their own slides, respond to the papers. We're going to follow that with about a 15-20 minute discussion. So please put any questions that you have. You can email events@brookings.edu, or you can join on Twitter using hashtag MuniFinance. So I'm going to let the first panelist, Louise Shiner from Brookings, is going to present. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. Let me share my screen. Is that, let's see. Good? No, not yet. Okay. Hold on. Sorry. Okay, thank you, Natalie. So I am going to be talking about state and local pension sustainability, and we're going to be talking about the effects of COVID-19. This work is joint with Jamie Lenny from the Bank of England and Finn Shula, who was at Hutchins Center with me, who is now starting at Brown University. And before I go on, I want to really recognize some amazing research assistance provided by Lorena Hernandez-Barcena and Jeffrey Chang. Especially Lorena took over this project just a month ago, and we had a lot of work to do, and it's very complicated. So she just did an amazing job. Also, hold on, what happened to the disclaimer? Hold on. Okay, I lost the disclaimer somehow. Slide two. Where's slide two? All right. Well, we have a disclaimer. Jamie works at the Bank of England. I don't know why it's not showing up. What we're going to present today are our views and not those of the Bank of England or anything associated with the Bank of England. Okay, quick intro. So in a paper actually presented last year at this conference, work joined with Byron Lutz and the co-authors here, we assess what state and local governments need to do to make their pension plans sustainable rather than to make them fully funded, which is what other people had looked at. Now economic conditions have changed, so we're going to assess how those changing economic conditions affect the sustainability of public pension plans. And then we're also going to explore the implications of state and local governments actually potentially cutting their pension contributions to smooth through the fiscal strain from the pandemic that we heard so much about yesterday. So quick background to kind of situate the paper. So most of the previous work on state and local pensions was focused on how to appropriately value the liabilities. The argument was the discount rate used by plans was too low, and therefore plans were less funded than people thought. So in the paper that we talked about that we presented last year, we said that may be true, but frankly, lack of full funding doesn't tell you that much. It doesn't imply that plans will face problems in the future, which most people assumed it did. Plans can actually be sustainable in the sense that the benefits are payable, while pension contributions as a share of GDP are constant without full funding. So another way of thinking about it is, what's a less than fully funded plan? Well, it's really just two pieces. It's a fully funded plan plus some implicit debt. Using riskless rates of return, plans have never been fully funded. So state and local governments just have always had pension debt on their books. So thinking about moving to full funding, that would be like paying off an existing debt. That makes current generation of taxpayers worse off relative to future generations. When we think of government debt, we tend to think that it's better to spread the costs over current and future generations by keeping it constant as a share of GDP. So you have to just pay enough so that of your interest costs so that debt isn't rising as a share of GDP. And then we say it's a sustainable debt picture. Okay. So using detailed actuarial projections and a nationally representative sample of 40 plans, we assessed last year what plans need to do to achieve sustainability. So now we're going to take those plans, that data, and that machinery and say, now let's incorporate the effects of COVID. One of the big questions here is about rates of return and discount rates, which is really key to this discussion. So as I said, the academic discussion has focused on the appropriate discount rate to compute the present value of accrued liabilities. Turns out that rate is just not very important when you're thinking about sustainability. And think about it this way. If what you mean by sustainability is that the cash flows are always sufficient to pay benefits, you never compute present values. You don't care about them, right? We never talk about the present value of Social Security benefits. We look at the cash flows. But of course, the rate of return on pension assets does matter. Now, you still want to think about adjusting that for risk. But the whole question about how to risk adjust that is very different, right? And so what is the appropriate risk adjusted rate for that calculation? The truth is, it's really not clear what the rate is. If we thought state and local governments were completely indifferent between investing in treasuries, maybe some combination of TIPS and other treasuries, and risky assets that had a higher expected return but higher risk, then the treasury rate would be the right rate. We say, look, it's equivalent to investing in treasuries, so use that. But if we think that these plans actually benefit, and there's a lot of reasons I don't have time to go into now, that you might think there might be a benefit to actually investing in risky assets, then that treasury rate's too low. But this area just is so ripe for research. It's ripe for research at both the state and local and the federal level, just how to think about risk and federal budget and budgeting and government budgeting. So we just use three deterministic rates of return because we don't want to get into that. We don't have for this paper. So we use the treasury rate as this risk-free rate. We use the average rate of returns plans of experience, and then we use something in the middle. Okay, so what are we doing for COVID? So we have two cases. One I call the CBO case. I frankly used to call it the optimistic case, and I realized that's ridiculous. This is not optimistic at all. This is a terrible recession. So we use the CBO economic forecast, which is lower GDP growth that takes about 10 years to get back to baseline, lower real wage growth, and a decline in state and local spending that's not as deep but lasts much longer than the decline in GDP. And we use that state and local forecast to try to forecast state and local employment and wages. On top of the CBO economic forecast, we actually look at what's happened to Treasury index, TIPS, the Treasury that are indexed for inflation. And we incorporate a 1.4 percentage point decline that we've observed since January. So a very, very large decline in TIPS. Okay, that's our CBO case. We also show you what I call a pessimistic case. So we take the CBO case and we add two things. We add a decline of 20% in pension asset values, which was kind of what we were thinking about when we first started talking about this in March, when the stock market had fallen so much. It has now recovered, but that could happen again. We also assume a 3/10 percentage point lower productivity growth in perpetuity because we think recessions can affect productivity growth. So there was lower productivity following the Great Recession. The economy never got back to its pre-recession baseline. And then the particular in this recession, between the lockdowns and working from home and supply chains that are disrupted, and frankly, this recognition that pandemics are something that we need to be preparing for and that might be happening, we think those all could impair productivity growth. So in our pessimistic assumption, we allow that to happen. Okay, what are we going to show you? What are the metrics? So we're going to show you three things. One is what happens to contribution change required to achieve what we call long-run sustainability. What does that mean? We're going to stabilize assets or debt or funding. It doesn't matter. As I said, it's all going to be the same in the long run as a share of GDP without regard to the level. We're going to say just find a level at which it's stable. That's the same thing as saying just make sure contributions are sufficient to pay benefits in perpetuity, right? But you might say, well, that's not realistic. Yeah, you know, that could involve using up all your assets. So we're also going to show you what happens if you don't allow that to happen, but you say, what we want to do is target the implicit debt as a share of GDP in 30 years and don't allow it to be any different from today's, right? So we're not going to allow debt to increase relative to today's in that sustainability exercise. And finally, we're going to look at what happens to asset exhaustions given COVID without doing anything. Okay, let me show you the first set of metrics. Okay, so this is telling you the change in payroll that you need to do to become sustainable over the long run with low, medium, and high asset returns. The reasons I write low, medium, and high is that I'm going to show you pre-COVID and post-COVID, and those returns mean different things pre-COVID and post. So if you look in the blue rectangle on the right, I tell you what those rates of return are. Pre-COVID, we use 1, 3, and 5 for low, medium, high. Post-COVID, we've taken them all down by 1.4 percentage points, the decline in tips that we've seen since January, so that our real low rate of return post-COVID is negative 0.4%. Our quote-unquote medium rate of return, which was our low rate of return last summer, basically, is 1.6%, and our high rate of return is 3.6. So these are very low rates of return. Okay, so in the red box shows you what happens in this long run exercise where we just stabilize without regard to what the debt level at which we stabilize is. So with very low rates of return, that first row, COVIDs really don't matter, right? So pre-COVID, you had to put in 12% of payroll. Post-COVID, for the CBO one, it's 12.2. Because of the productivity decrease, it's a little bit higher in the pessimistic, right? And that's because with negative rates of return or really low rates of return, assets don't buy you anything. You're basically going to stabilize at a pay-as-you-go plan. In that case, nothing about the current environment is really changing. With the medium high rates of return, that's not true. Lower rates of return and worse economics increase required contributions noticeably. Okay, if we go to the second exercise, which is saying, don't let it become pay as you go. Don't let the funding change from today. Stabilize your debt to GDP at the same level as today's, or at least get there in 30 years. Then for all rate of return assumptions, the required contributions do increase. But if you look at the middle panel relative to the blue one on its right, the blue one shows you what happens if you go for full funding. The effects are much, much smaller. So again, keeping a sustainability analysis in your head instead of a full funding means COVID is bad. You have to increase payroll contributions between 4 or 5 percentage points for the CBO scenario, but not like the 10 percentage points on top of the already astronomical 43% that you have to do for full funding. Okay. Now I'm going to just switch gears for a minute and talk about optimal pension funding policies during a pandemic. So state and local governments have balanced budget requirements that limit borrowing, but borrowing during recessions makes sense. Right, large cuts to public services because during the pandemic are going to probably be much more costly than smaller cuts spread over many years. And big reductions in state and local spending lengthen and deepen the recession. Right, state and local governments are a big player in the macroeconomy. While in the Great Recession, one of the reasons that the recovery was so slow and so long was because state and local governments took so long to get back to pre-recession trends or even levels of spending. Now, of course, it's likely preferable for federal government to do the borrowing and issue grants to state and local governments. We can see that, right? They have lower borrowing costs, they have more ability to bear debt, and they internalize economic spillovers across states, right? So if Georgia does something, it helps North Carolina, the federal government kind of internalizes it. But if those grants are insufficient, then things like rainy day funds and changes in pension funding policies can allow government to lower savings and limit spending cutbacks without violating the balanced budget rules. And with interest rates even lower than before the pandemic, the cost of this saving is lower and possibly negative, especially considering the macroeconomic spillovers of spending cuts. And I want to just emphasize that the mayor yesterday talked about thinking about the long run, and so are we. We're saying that, you know, it's possible that allowing your economy to get into a deeper and longer recession and for schools not to be able to open because you're not funding them. There's so many reasons that cutting back state and local services can really, really hurt you now and in the future. And so you just need to think about that. Okay. Now, okay, but would a moratorium in pension patients actually be a significant help? And the answer is yes. So for the U.S. as a whole, pension contributions in 2019 was 4.7% of own source revenues. GDP is going to be down maybe 6% in 2020, maybe more, and state and local revenues, what we heard yesterday, much more than that. Now, when we think about what we talked about yesterday about budget balances, rainy day funds plus surpluses, they were 3.2% of own source revenues at the end of 2019, and they can only be used once. Once they're used up, they're gone. Whereas pension contributions can be cut for several years, right? So cutting back on pension contributions could go a long way towards mitigating the spending cuts. So but then we're going to say, well, what are the sustainability implications of doing that? We're going to show you what happens if you do a moratorium on pension contributions for 3 years. That is just an illustrative example, right? That's a pretty big cut. Plans could not cut to go to zero. They could reduce them. They don't have to do it for 3 years. So this is just putting it on the table and showing what a very big cut would do. Okay. And when we look across the states, you know, if you look at unemployment rates in May and pension contributions, there are a lot of states with very high unemployment rates who are hit very hard by the pandemic who have a lot of money in pensions. And so it would be helpful for them. And similarly, if we're looking at plans with rainy day funds and budget balances and not, so this is budget balances on the x-axis and pension contributions on the y, there are a lot of plans who don't have big budget balances who do have a lot of pension contributions. So this is a good, this is kind of a big pot of money, okay? So let me just first show you what happens to asset exhaustion with the moratorium and just with COVID in general, because I didn't show you that before. So these, if you look at these bars, this is showing you the distribution of asset exhaustion pre-COVID, COVID under CBO, COVID under CBO with a 3-year moratorium, et cetera. And it tells you what share of plans are exhausted by when. So when you look at pre-COVID, 55% of the liabilities are in plans that are exhausted by 30 years. No plan is exhausted in the next 10 years. Once you include COVID, still no plans exhaust within 10, but 90% of liabilities are in plans that exhaust by 30 years. That big reduction in the interest rate really does make a huge difference in terms of exhaustion. The 3-year moratorium increases that to 97%, and 4% in liabilities then exhaust within 10 years. So exhaustion rates clearly speed up with the lower interest rates in particular. That's true for the medium. I'm not going to go through the numbers. It's true. The numbers are just smaller. Of course, the plans are in better shape, but it still speeds up exhaustion rates a lot. Okay. What about, okay, so you speed up your exhaustion rate, which means when you make an action after the recovery, you might want to act a little bit sooner, and you might have to do something bigger in order to sort of make up for the fact that you didn't contribute for 3 years if you want to become sustainable. So what this table is showing you is exactly that. What is the change in the contribution that you have to make just because of that 3-year moratorium? Okay, so for long run stability, that gray box where you allow plans to be less funded but stable after the moratorium actually lowers the required contributions that you have to make or raises them very little when you have low and even the moderate rates of return. Why is that? When rates of return are below the economic growth rate, so R less than G is something that people talk about all the time, assets are actually expensive to maintain. Your interest isn't enough to keep your assets. If you didn't put more money in, your assets would be declining. So the moratorium reduces assets, and that actually sort of makes everybody better off. When you go to the same debt to GDP in 30 years, that the orangey middle one, that's no longer true because you're not allowing yourself to stay at this lower level of assets. You're going to make yourself build it back up because that's the exercise that we're doing. And then rates have to go up after the moratorium relative to before, but really not that much. Okay, conclusions. So COVID puts plans in worse shape. Lower payroll means lower contributions, and particularly lower rates of return means less asset income. Asset exhaustion comes sooner for many plans. But the real risk-adjusted return over the 20-year horizon is now negative and well below the growth rate of the economy. That says there's less rush to increase contributions and really little cost of a moratorium. And state and local governments are under tremendous fiscal strain due to the COVID recession, which could entail spending cuts that are bad for the macroeconomy and bad for constituents. So if the federal government does not pass a big enough aid package, plan sponsors should consider reducing their pension contributions in order to free up budget space, as the cost for their communities may well be below the benefits. This is probably not going to be the right thing to do for every plan, but I think it's likely that it is the right thing to do for many plans, and it should at least be on the table. Thank you.
Okay.
I have to pass it over to Bob and Josh.
Okay. Next group, next paper. Thank you.
Hi. Thank you. Our paper has two major objectives. First is to better understand pension funding dynamics, and specifically we refer to Louise's paper from last year, which is all we actually had on hand. We more generally look at how to incorporate risk into the analysis of funding policy for intergenerational equity, which is the big question that their paper raised, and appropriately so. So first, just in form of context, we're all familiar with the rising pension costs. This is just an illustration with regard to pension costs for K-12 education using the metric of per pupil expenditures. They've tripled over the last 15 years from about $500 per pupil to over $1,500. And this is due to rising debt service payments. And the LLS paper, Louise's paper from last year and this year, rightly raises the question, do we need to pay down the debt? So we're going to dig a little deeper into understanding the key features of the LLS model in a deterministic context. The first feature is that the debt rollover untethers asset accumulation from liabilities. The second feature that we want to delve into and understand better is the impact of using a low-risk discount rate for liabilities while maintaining a risky return on assets in your assumptions. This was presented last year as a conservative assumption. We've been pointing out over the last year that it actually has little effect on the contribution rate in a debt rollover policy, so long as the assumed rate of return is unchanged. Dropping the discount rate doesn't have much effect. So this is a puzzle. We just want to delve a little deeper into understanding why that is the case, that a drop in the discount rate doesn't raise contributions under this policy. We're going to use a little bit of math to isolate the two features. One is the assumption of arbitrage profits between the risky returns and the low-risk interest rate. And secondly, the delinking of contributions from liabilities. We'll then turn to introducing risk. Josh will be presenting that to address the question of what the future risks are of the debt rollover policy. We'll then finally turn to a general policy analysis, a framework for the big question of intergenerational trade-offs with risk. We take a first stab at it in this paper, portraying the trade-off between the various choices of the current contribution rate versus the expected value of future contributions. And then we'll close with some extensions that we anticipate in our future work. So first, just to review some basic pension math so you can understand the math results that we'll present later on. First, just the standard asset growth equation. Assets grow by investment earnings, where R is the rate of return on risky assets. We add in contributions. Little C is the contribution rate as a percent of payroll. Payroll is capital W. And this is the pay-go rate, of course, representing the benefit payments. The point of this that we draw from this expression, which we all use, is that the funding policy simultaneously determines the trajectory of contributions. Of course, it determines that more or less directly, but and also simultaneously the asset accumulation path. These are the flip sides of the same coin, and we're going to look at both sides. So before we do that, just to put on the parallel expression for liabilities. Liabilities grow by the interest on old liabilities. I'll put in red the discount rate D. This is the point in question. What is the impact of that? And of course, we also have to add in new liabilities, normal costs, and net out the payments which extinguish old liabilities. So the modeling aspect we're focusing on here in this particular presentation is what's the impact of setting the discount rate below the rate of return. And to see the implications, we're going to first simulate that debt rollover policy for the CalSTRS system because it had a good publicly available cash flows. And we'll do it under two scenarios. First, where the discount rate equals the assumed rate of return at 6% nominal. That was essentially the preferred rate in the LLS paper last year. And then drop the discount rate to 4% while leaving the assumed return at 6%. So first, let's have a look at it in that first scenario where both are equal to 6%. And we're going to look at assets and liabilities using the metric as a portion or multiple of payroll. So we have the liabilities up here following a path that more or less reaches some sort of something close to a steady state. Assets start down here, a funded ratio of about 60%. A full funding asset accumulation path would bring, of course, assets up to liabilities. The debt rollover policy has a more modest goal, which is to simply maintain the distance between the two, again, as a multiple of payroll. So it's a parallel path. The point, now we drop the discount rate to 4% and see what happens. Well, of course, naturally, the liabilities jump. That's the point. that everybody knows about. But the asset accumulation path stays essentially unchanged. The funding ratio correspondingly dropped. So this illustrates, we think, graphically how it is that under the debt rollover policy, asset accumulation is essentially untethered from liabilities, a key point to bear in mind. Now let's look at the flip side of the coin, which is the contributions under these two policy, under these two scenarios. First, let's go back to the initial scenario where both the discount rate and assumed return are 6%. This is all, again, as a percent of payroll. We have the PAYGO rate up here. It's pretty high, much higher than anything else we're going to be talking about. The contribution rate is down here. It stabilizes somewhere below it. But it is, and it is, of course, reduced from what would have been the case under the full funding policy. Under the full funding policy, Louise's point is that we'd be much higher here and then drop down. So this levels it out for the entire projection period. However, it is still the case that the contribution rate, even with the lower discount rate, it's not the lower discount rate, still at the 6% discount rate, still exceeds the normal cost rate. Now let's drop the discount rate to 4%, and this will be my last slide before I turn it over to Josh. The PAYGO rate, of course, is unchanged. The normal cost rate, of course, jumps. When you reduce the discount rate, the normal cost rate jumps. But the point here is that the contribution rate essentially does not change. To go through the math, use the math I laid out before to try and explain, shed more insight as to why that is the case. First way of looking at it is for a steady state ratio of assets to payroll. We have this equation here. The contribution rate equals the PAYGO rate minus some amount of the investment returns, but the discount rate doesn't enter into it at all. So the point here is that so long as the steady state asset ratio is untethered from the liabilities, then the contribution rate is unaffected by a drop in the discount rate for liabilities. Final way of looking at it, and I don't know if you have it all on the screen, the whole equation there, the last part is what's important here, is the debt rollover policy has a three-piece component to the contribution rate. There is the normal cost, there's some debt service, much below what would be under full funding, but there's a negative term here that offsets it, which is the arbitrage profits, the difference between the risky rate of return and the low-risk discount rate, times whatever assets you have on hand. The point being, these arbitrage profits are risky. They're used to keep the contributions low. I now turn it over to Josh.
All right. So I think I'm unmuted now. All right, so Bob has shown that the debt rollover policy is making the same risky bet on asset returns that plans are making today, but with a much lower long-term asset base. I'm going to transition to explicitly talking about risk. Our conversation today has been grappling with three concepts regarding risk. The first is sustainability, which the previous presentation discussed extensively. However, this concept is relatively subjective and generally tied up with the economic condition of jurisdiction, so this is not going to be our focus. The remainder of our presentation will focus on the latter two concepts on this slide. A plan reaches PAYGO when it runs out of assets and must make benefit payments from the annual budget. PAYGO is a huge risk. The benefit payments rate is a natural contribution threshold, but most governments are contributing far less than PAYGO rate. So if plans exhaust their assets, contributions would have to increase from around 25% of payroll to around 40% of payroll. To put this in context, so for Illinois teachers, that's about a $1.3 billion increase, or about a 25% increase in dollar terms. For Pennsylvania teachers, that's about a $1.5 billion increase, or a 30% increase in dollar terms. So this is a big increase that would be incurred if plans exhaust their assets completely. Second concept here is intergenerational equity, which has arguably been the biggest challenge pensions have faced. Both contributions and benefit levels have swung wildly over the last 30 years. The longevity of traditional pensions depends on finding a way to achieve intergenerational equity with guaranteed benefits and a big bet on risky assets. All right. When you model pension cash flows, risky assets create two types of uncertainty. You have uncertainty about what the long-term average return is going to be. That's illustrated here with the different rates of return. But you also have uncertainty about year-to-year returns, even if you get the long-term return right. Don Boyd and team have done a great job of highlighting this in past work. The challenge with pension funding is not how to make the math work in a deterministic world, but rather how to manage uncertainty created by large, risky investments. So we run 1 million 100-year simulations using three different nominal return and standard deviation combinations derived from publicly available capital market assumptions. We base it on Cowan's assumptions, but we've also used BlackRock's and JP Morgan. We're using CalSTRS, which is a conservative example because the non-investment cash flow is relatively neutral. That is, their contributions and benefit payments are pretty close together. We model the 33% contribution rate LLS calculates would stabilize CalSTRS debt to payroll ratio. Again, as Bob pointed out, Louise and team is right that for plans with substantial assets and manageable non-investment cash flow, the risk of paygo will not increase much over the next 20 years. However, even for these relatively stable plans, the risk of paygo increases dramatically after that. You can see this in our graph. The probability is stable until about 20 years out and then increases substantially with disproportionately more risk for lower rates of return. You also saw this in the previous presentation with the dramatic increase in the probability of reaching paygo given the lower rates of return post-COVID. But even for a 6% expected return, even if we get the center of the distribution right, the annual return variation creates a wide distribution of potential outcomes. You can see the widespread of potential funded ratios from our simulations on this slide. Again, we see somewhat asymmetric risk tilted towards the downside. There's a 25% chance CalSTRS will run out of money in 40 years, even if the average long-term return was 6%. The challenge that pensions create for intergenerational equity is it's hard to capture the risk that a given funding or investment policy is placing on future generations. This makes it very difficult to know whether each generation is paying their fair share or just rigging the system to make it look like they are. In our paper, we propose a new metric that is a start towards better capturing contribution risk faced by future generations. It's the probability-weighted contribution rates of paygo, full funding, and the funding policy in between. In other words, it's the paygo rate multiplied by the probability of reaching paygo, and so on. The graph displays the expected contribution metric across three return values. Employing a 33% constant contribution rate would lead to rising expected contributions in a 6% return world and steeply rising contributions in a 5% return world. Those are the blue and the orange lines, respectively. This increase is driven by the paygo risk created by a debt rollover policy. Our metric is agnostic about funding policy and highlights a consistent truth about pension funding. Regardless of the funding policy, lower contributions now increase the likelihood of higher contributions later. This graph, which models multiple contribution rates, demonstrates this concept. Our implicit definition of generational equity is a relatively flat expected contribution curve. The 33% line is the same as the previous graph, and the 36 and 40% lines show how increasing contributions a bit now can lead to lower expected contributions in the future. So, conclusions. The previous paper's authors are right to highlight the intergenerational equity challenges pension funding creates and the crowd out state and local governments have already experienced and are probably going to experience in the future. However, their proposed debt rollover policy would exacerbate those challenges in two ways. First, it would significantly increase the chances of reaching paygo. In fact, this latest iteration makes this a somewhat explicit goal. The vast majority of plans would exhaust in 30 years based on the graph that we saw. But, so they also said that R is less than D. If R is less than D, then paygo is economically efficient. We completely agree with that. But paygo is accompanied with a big contribution increase, which we can't lose sight of, and comes with its own set of risks for workers and taxpayers. And there's no guarantee that R is less than G or that relationship holds forever. Second, it would further decouple liabilities from contributions. Here, it's worth noting that the reason benefit payments have nearly reached a peak is because benefits have been dramatically reduced over the last 20 years. These reductions were driven by an increased pension cost that were the result of liabilities and contributions being linked by standard actuarial practice. The linking of liabilities and assets caused the rising pension cost and resulted in the reduction in benefits, which is why there is a peak. Without this constraint or something similar, it's hard to imagine a defined benefit system that achieves intergenerational equity. There's got to be a constraint to keep benefits in line with the money available. The challenge with pension funding is not who has the right crystal ball or silver bullet. Instead, it's how to effectively and fairly manage risk. We need to reconceptualize how we achieve the goal of intergenerational equity in a risky world, and our proposed expected contribution metric is a start to better incorporating risk and its impact on future cost in funding policy deliberations. So our future work, we're gonna build out our simulations to incorporate a wider array of funding policies and plans. We'll do more to expand the theory around— All right, I'll hand it off to Don Boyden team.
Okay. So good morning. So in this paper, we're going to examine the potential impacts of adopting risk-sharing policies for the finances of public sector pension plans and the benefits for plan members. So this is the joint work with Don Boyd and Gong Chen at the Center for Policy Research, Rockefeller College, University at Albany, and we'd like to thank Arnold Ventures for the financial support of this work. So in traditional public sector defined benefit plans, employers generally bear all risks, including investment, longevity, and inflation risks. With increasing costs and risk in DB plans, state and local governments have sought to share one or more of these risks with employees during working years or retirement years or both. In recent years, several state pension plans have introduced risk-sharing policies such as contingent cost of living adjustments, or COLAs, and contingent employee contributions. Risk-sharing policies can reduce government costs and risks while retaining key features of DB plans at the expense of increased risk and potentially reduced income for plan members. So as governments seek ways to control pension costs and risks while providing competitive compensation to public employees, it will be increasingly important to understand how risk-sharing mechanisms affect costs and risks to pension plans, governmental employers, and plan members. The impacts of risk-sharing policies depend on uncertain future events, particularly investment returns, and are best analyzed with methods that take into account uncertainty and volatility of investment return. In this paper, we build on our previous work on risk-sharing policies by extending a stochastic simulation model to examine a series of stylized risk-sharing policies constructed based on policies in use. To better put the analysis into context, we will first examine the impacts of these policies and their deterministic scenario with a severe severe adverse asset shock similar to the one used in the Dodd-Frank stress testing scenario. We will then examine stochastic scenarios with uncertain and volatile investment returns. We will examine the long-term and the short-term impact of risk-sharing policies on employer contributions and member benefits. For the impact on employers, we look at the long-term overall employer cost and the short-term volatility of employer contributions. For the impact on plan members, we will examine the lifetime values of benefits and the stability of annual benefit payments. In our simulation model, we construct a baseline policy with no risk-sharing mechanism and four stylized risk-sharing policies constructed based on real-world plans with simplifications. We assume a constant inflation rate of 2% for all policies, and we use this constant inflation because the main focus of this study is investment risk, not inflation risk. The baseline policy has a constant 1.5% annual COLA, which does not fully keep up with the inflation. Among the four risk-sharing policies we examined, two are contingent COLA policies. Under the first one, COLA is triggered by investment return, and a 2% COLA is only granted if the prior year's return is greater than the threshold of 7.5%, which is set equal to the assumed return of the plan. And the second one, COLA is triggered by a single threshold of 90% funded ratio, and no COLA is granted if funded ratio falls below this level. We also examined two contingent employee contribution policies. Employee contribution rate ranges from 3 to 7% depending on prior year's return in the first one, and in the second one, employee contribution rate have the same range but depends on funded ratio in the prior year. In most simulations, we assume that the plan starts with a 75% funded ratio, which is quite common for public pension plans. We first demonstrate how different risk-sharing policies would affect employer costs and pension benefits under a hypothetical asset shock scenario. We assume that there is a 24% investment loss in year two, followed by a three-year recovery period with annual returns of 12%, and after that, the annual returns stay constant at 7.5%. This figure shows the employer contribution as a percentage of payroll under different policies. The black line represents the baseline scenario with no risk sharing. The asset shock in year two causes employer contribution rate to rise by 8 percentage points from 17% to 25% in about 5 years. The two blue lines represent the contingent COLA policies. The funded ratio-based COLA policy, the dark blue line, has stronger cost-reducing and volatility-dampening effects, which is about 3 percentage points in year 10, as the plan does not achieve the 90% funding threshold for COLA until after year 11 and grants no COLA before that. The return-based COLA policy shows minimal effect under this asset shock scenario because only the COLA in year 2 is affected. The two green lines represent the contingent employee contribution policies. The impacts of the funded ratio-based policy, funded ratio-based employee contribution policy, the dark green line, is similar to the funded ratio-based COLA policy in early years after the asset shock, while it has higher costs afterwards as it only temporarily shifts costs to employees and does not reduce total pension benefit costs. The stylized return-based employee contribution policy, the light green line, only reduces the employer contribution rate in the year right after the asset shock because the cost sharing in this particular policy design only depends on the investment return in the prior year. Risk-sharing policies' employer cost-reducing effects come at the cost of reduced benefit for retirees or higher contributions for active members. Here we will focus on the impact on benefits. We examine the impact on individual retirees by looking at the stream of inflation-adjusted benefits that reflect the true purchasing power of the payments for a single cohort who retire in year one at age 60. The figure shows the inflation-adjusted benefits, which is indexed to $100 in year one over a 15-year period. We see that the purchasing power of the benefit declines by 20% under funded ratio-based COLA policy because of the extended period of COLA suspension. So one important conclusion from the analysis of the deterministic asset shock scenario is that risk-sharing policies that are contingent on investment returns in a single year provide very little protection against an asset shock if it is followed by returns above the COLA threshold. However, when returns can vary from year to year, the story can be very different, as each year in which returns are below the threshold will result in a lower COLA or higher employee contributions. By contrast, under this return scenario, policies contingent on the funding ratio have larger impacts and for longer periods of time. The full effects of risk-sharing policies can be best understood in stochastic simulation settings. Our stochastic scenario assumes that the expected long-run compound mean return is equal to the plan's assumed return of 7.5% and a standard deviation of 12%. Note that in any individual simulation run, the 40-year compound average return can be higher or lower than the plan's return assumption of 7.5%, and we run 2,000 simulations for each policy. To investigate how these policies perform under different investment return levels, we divide the 2,000 simulations into quintiles based on the 40-year compound average returns. In each quintile, we compare the median values of our cost or benefit measures and the risk-sharing policies to the baseline in the same quintile. The table shows the results for the overall employer contribution cost, which is measured by the present value of total employer contributions over a 40-year period. And the overall median result under the baseline is normalized to 100. And here we only show results for the three quintiles with the highest, the middle, and the lowest returns. We can see that under the baseline, our index of total employer cost varies across return quintiles. And columns to the right shows the impact of different risk-sharing policies against these baseline values. For example, the return-based COLA lowers the median employer cost by about 6.1% in the middle quintile, by 6.5% in the lowest return quintile, and by 4.7% in the highest return quintile. The two contingent COLA policies provide moderate cost-reducing effects ranging from 4 to 10% compared to the baseline, and the effects are stronger in lower return groups. The two stylized contingent employee contribution policies have quite limited impact on employer pension costs. Next, we look at the impact on employer contribution volatility, which we measured by the maximum increase in employer contribution as a percentage of payroll in any five-year period. We found that the measures for all four policies do not differ greatly from the base in their corresponding quintiles, meaning none of these policies exhibit strong contribution volatility dampening effects under this measure. We next analyze how pension benefits are affected by risk-sharing policies. Again, we focus on a single cohort of retirees who retired at age 60 in year one, and we normalize the year one benefit payments to 100 and apply COLAs from the simulations. We do not present the results for the contingent employee contribution policies as they do not affect benefits. To demonstrate how the impact of the funded ratio-based policy is affected by starting funded status of a plan, we also present results for an additional simulation scenario in which the plan starts with a 100% funded ratio. So this table shows the present value of lifetime benefits payments under different policies and return quintiles. The third column shows the present value of total benefits under the baseline, which is constant across return groups. And the columns to the right shows the median percentage differences from the baseline under the three risk-sharing policies. The return-based COLA policy under the return-based COLA policy, the reduction in the present value of benefits ranges from 3.2% in the highest return quintile to 5.1% in the lowest return quintile. And for the funded ratio-based COLA policy, if starting with a 75% funded ratio, the benefit reduction can be large in the lowest return group. The present value of the benefit is 9% lower than the baseline, which are equivalent to losing benefit accrual of 1.5%, 1.5 year of service. Starting with a 100% funded ratio would result in much higher benefits, while the variation across return groups is still large. So finally, we examine the impact stability of pension benefits. The sharp declines in benefits or low benefits in certain time periods may cause welfare losses. Real benefits would decrease when the grant COLA rate falls short of the inflation. We examine the risk of large decline in inflation-adjusted benefit in a short time period, which is measured by the maximum decrease in real benefit within five years during retirement. Under the baseline policy, the real annual benefit decreased by 2.4% every 5 years as the fixed COLA rate is lower than the assumed inflation rate. Under the contingent COLA policies, retirees may face much larger real benefit decreases. The maximum 5-year real benefit decrease can be 3 to 4 times as large as the baseline. When the plan starts with the full funding under the funded ratio-based COLA policy, the maximum 5-year decrease of real benefit are substantially lower in higher return groups. So the main conclusions are, first, the continuing call-up policies we examined here can moderately reduce employer employer pension costs in the long term, and they can provide a meaningful cost reduction in persistent low-return environments. While the continuing employee contribution policies examined here have very small impact on total pension costs. And all policies we examined only reduce the volatility of employer contributions marginally. On the other hand, these risk-sharing policies could create a substantial benefit risk for retirees. We also see that the design of risk-sharing policies, such as which conditioning factor to use, will also have large effects on its impact. Finally, we think that if employers wish to achieve significant risk reduction through risk-sharing policies, these policies would have to transfer far more risk to employees than the policies examined here, which are representative of many policies currently in use. So this work is still preliminary, and we will further extend the analysis, and eventually we will turn this into a clear and concise policy guidebook, which will help policymakers to make well-informed choices. And any comments and suggestions about how to make this more useful to policymakers are welcome. Thank you. So I will turn to Tom.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, and good afternoon to everyone. And what I wanted to do as I begin my presentation is just to do a bit of framing for the potential that just some members in the audience are not completely familiar with Moody's and our market role as a credit rating agency. And as we look at the U.S. public pension issue and the notion of pension risk for sponsoring state and local governments, the lens through which we view this issue is always in terms of risk to bondholders. We assign credit ratings to bonds that, you know, give a signal of our independent opinion of the risk of, you know, not receiving payment in time and in full to a bondholder. And, you know, so our assessment of pensions, our ratings are not on pension or pension systems. They're on the sponsoring government. But certainly since pensions and, you know, meaning active employees, retirees, and their benefits are competing for the same resources of a sponsoring government, you know, when pensions become a financial challenge for a sponsoring entity, that in turn can become a credit issue for bondholders. So just a bit of a framing commentary there for the audience. So another framing comment before I get into discussing, I think, some of the really interesting and important observations of the authors that have spoken thus far. And our observation is that as we enter the current economic downturn, the risks that state and local governments face related to pensions are higher this go round than going into 2008-2009. And we can, the way that we come up with this conclusion is really divided into four categories that you see here on the slide. Number one, the unfunded liabilities, what you could call the pension debt, if you will, is larger. You can see here over $4 trillion, according to the Federal Reserve, as of 2019. So, you know, kind of pre-coronavirus economic impact. The cost, just the annual budget hit, that's been discussed quite a bit by a number of the authors already today. And for many governments, those contributions are consuming a greater share of their annual resources than they ever have, or at least close to it. On the other hand, you know, kind of tying this back to debt markets a little bit, our observation has consistently been that funding at actuarial levels oftentimes does not really pay down the unfunded liability, even using reported assumptions. So we have this measure we call a tread water indicator, which basically is, you know, under reported assumptions, what's the cost to keep the pension debt in nominal dollars flat? And, you know, oftentimes the ARC or the ADC, these actuarial contributions don't actually do that. They negatively amortize for a while, allowing the unfunded liability to grow in a baseline scenario. That's very different than the way municipal bonds are typically amortized, which is, you know, with level debt service over the expected useful life of the financed assets. So, there, just thinking about the budget, certainly higher risk today than getting into the past recession. The scale of the assets, about the same heading into the current economic downturn. And then the fourth point that I'd like to, and I think I'm going to focus my discussion comments on over the next couple of slides, is that the cash flow is weaker. Josh alluded to this briefly in his comments, and he also used the same term, non-investment cash flow, or we just abbreviate it NICFA. That's actually just the contributions in from governments and employees, less the benefits out the door. So it sort of cuts out all the discounting and all the actuarial math and just gets to pure cash flow. So cash in the door, less cash out, but ignoring investment returns. And today, not unsurprisingly, the non-investment cash flow is more significantly negative relative to system assets than it was heading into the past recession. And there's a reason for that. Not only is it the underfunding, but also it's demographic maturity. So you've got a very large baby boomer cohort that's in or nearing retirement. And what that's doing is elevating the benefit outflows of the system. So in other words, the benefit outflows are not even over time. We're kind of in this demographic lump that's going to last the next couple of decades for many U.S. public pension systems. So in our assessment, this all actually drills down to one key point, and that is going into this, we actually look at state and local governments as having less capacity to smooth or defer contributions than they did going into the last recession, at least as far as the consequences for future pension asset accumulation are concerned. So what I wanted to go through in this slide is, I think, a key point, again, and this gets a bit to some of Louise's comments, and that is that since we have this heightened level of negative non-investment cash flow, many pension systems' asset positions stand to, you know, frankly, worsen considerably if incoming cash flow declines. And because of that, our view is that government decisions over the next couple of years pertaining to their level of contributions is going to be a differentiating factor in their pension funding risk. And that, in turn, impacts the affordability of their debt. Again, tying it back to our role as a credit rating agency. And that is because pensions effectively are must-pay obligations. When the rubber hits the road, our observation has been in a small number of municipal bankruptcies out there, pensions are arguably treated senior to debt. So these are certainly must-pay. And any decisions that increase the risk of pensions becoming truly unaffordable, in turn, enhance the risk facing bondholders. And to illustrate this, what I wanted to show graphically is an example large pension system in the U.S. where the current contribution policy is to contribute at a constant rate relative to payroll. And a couple things you can see in the chart. This is basically in a simulation of what we call the results asset benefit coverage. That's simply assets divided by benefit outflows. So you can kind of think of it as a point in time, a very simplistic measure of the number of years of benefit payments that the assets can cover. Another way of measuring funding health without the noise, if you will, of discount rates. And what you can see in the green, that's sort of the baseline, middle 50% outcomes in a stochastic simulation. So one, a pretty wide range of outcomes given the impact of investment return volatility. And they're, you know, about a 1 in 4 chance of running out of assets by 2045. But if you were to implement a 3-year contribution moratorium, you can see how the distribution of that middle 50% of outcomes shifts down substantially. I think this is consistent, actually, with some of the other authors' comments that, lowering near-term contributions moves in the paygo potential in terms of a timeline and increases that risk. And in fact, for this particular system, we would assign almost a 40% probability of depleting assets by 2045 if there were a 3-year contribution moratorium. I think it's important to point out that, and I think, you know, I'm reiterating a point Louise made. This was just sort of their, kind of pick a number. Let's just put that out there and assess what it would look like mathematically. I'm not aware of any governments actually proposing at this time, a 3-year contribution moratorium. So, I mean, just to be clear, we're kind of talking theoretically. But I think it's also important to talk about some of the additional risks associated with going to pay-as-you-go. Number one, we call the PAYGO jump or the cost increase. So if you're switching to funding benefits directly out of a budget, as opposed to, you know, contributing and setting assets aside, oftentimes that's a far more expensive proposition in terms of just how large the contributions are relative to the budget. And with no asset cushion, there's no ability of the plan sponsor to pull back on contributions without impairing benefits. And again, tying this back to bondholder risk, if pension benefits are going to be impaired, you know, our observation has been that actually the debt gets impaired first in all likelihood. And the other item that's not often discussed, but, you know, in terms of a pension system's cash flows, oftentimes employee contributions may comprise a significant portion of the annual contribution inflow. And, you know, whether it's legal or not, I think that it's an important risk to acknowledge that there's probably a practical risk to employees maybe being hesitant to have a portion of their paycheck deducted and sent towards an insolvent pension system for fear of not receiving their own benefits in the future. So I think there's some political and or practical risk there that's important to consider when we talk about PAYGO. And so my final slide, what I just want to do is, what I wanted to do with this is come up with what I thought was a consistent observation and theme across all of the papers, or a consistent conclusion. And I think that is that in this new lower for longer interest rate environment, that translates to higher risks associated with being a guarantor of annuities, plain and simple. And that is just a mathematical reality that cannot be overcome. On the right-hand side of this chart, this shows the way that currently most public pension systems are dealing with this. This is CalPERS assumed rate of return, which doubles their discount rate, but less the FTSE pension liability index. That's a high-grade AA corporate bond index. And so you can see that that spread is now at a historical high. And that translates to a lot of volatility risk, because in order to have a return target at 7%, which is so much higher than the prevailing market interest rates for high-grade fixed income, basically that means asset allocations in volatile classes like equities, private equity, and other alternatives. And so basically, rather than on a reported basis dramatically increasing the cost of the benefits being accrued through assumption changes, what systems have done is taken on more investment risk. And if we tie this to the paper that Don Boyd and his colleagues put together, what I would say is, you know, their finding is very interesting and not surprising. When you add contingencies to benefits that you know, shift some of that risk, that certainly provides some downside protection. And you'll notice in their results, the lower the returns, right, the more impactful that savings was. So that's not a surprising result. But on the other hand, tying back to the theme and the title of this slide here, the materiality of the risk reduction from some of the contingent policies was somewhat limited. And that speaks again to the theme that, you know, providing essentially close to risk-free annuities in a low interest rate environment is costly and or requires a lot of risk taking. Just a municipal market observation I wanted to add that I find noteworthy in relation to Don and his colleagues' findings is that COLAs, the power of compounding over time, certainly can comprise a significant portion of accrued liabilities. And so I think it's not coincidental that a lot of the litigation over benefit changes we've seen in the past decade oftentimes swirls around issues of protections for COLAs, or said differently, government flexibility to amend them. And then in terms of Bob and Josh's paper,
if you could up a little quickly, yeah.
Okay, one concluding comment, I'm gonna move it. Okay, well, I'll conclude there. You can see the comments on the slides. What I'm gonna do is just stop sharing my screen, and next discussant is up.
Thanks, Tom. So I enjoy reading each of these papers and really appreciate each of the authors' contribution to the field of public pensions. First, I'm going to talk about the paper by Professor Costrell and Dr. McGee, and the Shiner et al. Paper I'll address less directly, and I'll be addressing their paper from last year. And I share what I perceived as the reticence of Dr. Costrell and Dr. McKee to support a pension funding policy that does not seek to eliminate unfunded liabilities, excuse me, over a conventional time frame, like 15 or 25 years. Allowing unfunded liabilities to linger increases the risk significantly in some cases of much higher costs, including costs incurred due to potential plan insolvency. There are a number of groups, including the GFOA, the government GASB, professional actuarial organizations, as well as various task forces, blue ribbon panels, and bond rating agencies, such as Moody's that Tom represents, that have all over the years expressed in one form or another the importance of funding pension benefits in advance and amortizing unfunded liabilities within a limited time frame, chiefly based on the principles of intergenerational equity and simple financial prudence. There are some public pension plans, including those in West Virginia and Connecticut, and some other places, that operated on a pay-as-you-go basis for many years. And the effect of that practice in those and other states has been a legacy of substantial indebtedness that's been passed on to this and future generations. That said, I think we have to acknowledge that some public pension unfunded liabilities are truly legacy obligations, accrued in some cases over decades, before actuarial principles were fully developed, and before conventional wisdom demanded the use of more strict accounting and actuarial standards. It seems to me to some extent unfair to burden current taxpayers and plan participants with the full cost of eliminating this burden in a relatively short time frame, simply because someone finally came to their senses and decided it's time to do something about this problem. I wonder if it would be fair to split the baby and concede that in the interest of fairness, the unfunded liability might be amortized over a longer funding period, longer than 15 or even 30 years, than is called for by modern finance and actuarial standards. How about a special 50-year bond to eliminate these unfunded liabilities that accrued over decades prior to any of us coming along and that still linger? Doing that instead of burdening the current generation of taxpayers or pension plan participants, we'd be spreading out the cost over an extended time frame so that no one group unduly bears the burden of years of financial and actuarial malpractice. In the current environment, states could likely negotiate very favorable rates for an issuance like that. And an issuance like that might be accompanied by a covenant requiring that all other pension liabilities be amortized over a designated shorter time frame. And we've seen this actually happen in a number of states in recent years. And perhaps accompanied also or funded wholly or in part with a dedicated funding source, which we've also seen develop around the country in recent years, like a dedicated sales tax or a portion of future budget surplus monies. And I want to move on to addressing the Don Boyd paper on risk sharing plans. And Don Boyd and his colleagues. Although it's not entirely new to public pensions, as discussed by their paper, the use of risk-sharing plan designs in the public sector really has surged in recent years. In one important respect, most public pension plans have been risk-sharing all along, and that's through the requirement of employee contributions, and which is a marked difference from corporate pension plans, which never required or permitted employees to contribute. Aside from employee contributions, though, public pension risk sharing through other forms, like employee contributions that could increase or fall based on the condition of the plan, has become more common and more pronounced, especially over the last quarter century or so. The modern era of risk sharing began in earnest in the mid-90s with adoption of a hybrid DB-DC plan in Washington state. A strong argument could be made that risk sharing serves as a backstop to defined benefit plans that without risk sharing would have switched to a defined contribution plan. Were it not for risk sharing plan designs in some states, I'm certain that some public sector pension plans very likely would have switched to 401k type plans. One takeaway for me from the Boyd and his colleagues' paper is that it illustrates how expensive a cost of living adjustment really is. The contrast in the effect of a risk-sharing plan that adjusts the COLA compared to one that adjusts just the employer or employee contribution rate is really striking. And although I think risk-sharing plan designs have much to commend them, the use of flexible or contingent COLAs raises other issues, which is the impediments in place to using a COLA to inject risk-sharing into a pension plan. One of those impediments is that not all public pension plans have an automatic COLA. And so those plans lack the mechanism to come in and make adjustments based on other factors such as investment performance or actuarial return. And COLAs like that, basically ad hoc COLAs, would not appear to offer the opportunity to make plan design changes that can offer a very large bang for the buck to reduce costs and risks. Another potential impediment is that plans with more limited COLAs, such as, say, one half of CPI not to exceed 2%, would appear to offer more limited potential risk reduction and cost savings. And then a third impediment is that COLAs in some cases may not be an effective way for introducing risk sharing because benefit adjustments that affect current plan participants in some states like Illinois and California, among others, are not permitted by legal protections. In other words, the existing COLA for existing plan participants can't be touched. I want to speak for a moment about a couple of examples of risk sharing plan design that are not included in their paper that might be worth mentioning. New Brunswick, Canada, and the city of Houston each offer risk-sharing plan designs that feature multiple factors subject to adjustment. In the case of New Brunswick, both employee contributions and benefit levels are subject to change, depending on the result of an annual risk assessment or stress test. In Houston, not only employee contributions and benefit levels, but potentially actuarial methods and assumptions also are subject to revision, based, again, on annual required actuarial valuations. These annual assessments or valuations play a vital role in ensuring that the plans stay on target and do not get too far out of balance. So rather than waiting several years, in some cases, to make needed adjustments, these plans are required by law to make adjustments in a timely manner in order to keep the plans on track toward defined funding goals. Additional research in this area might be interesting would be analysis of plans like these that have multiple factors subject to adjustment depending on the financial and actuarial performance of the plan. And again, I want to express my appreciation for all of this research because it promotes the goal of stronger and more financially responsible retirement benefits for public employees, which directly or indirectly benefit everyone. Thanks.
Thanks, Keith, and thank you to all the panelists and those of you in the audience who are listening. We have a brief amount of time for questions and answers. It's about 15 minutes. We have a hard stop so that we can go to the next panel. If you are a viewer, you can submit a question by emailing events@brookings.edu, or you can go onto Twitter and use hashtag MuniFinance. We have a couple of questions. Well, actually, what I'd like to do is allow our panelists to spend just a few wee minutes asking and discussing with each other. I know that, since the two first papers were counterpoints to each other, I would allow someone from the Shiner team, I don't know whether that's Byron or someone else, to just make a few comments briefly, please. Okay. You're off, you're muted. You're muted, Byron. Uh-oh, you're muted.
Byron, are you on the phone?
He's talking, but he's muted.
That do it?
There you go.
Yeah, okay.
I'm on the phone.
Okay. Yes, I know.
Okay. Thank you for the opportunity to respond. I'll try to keep it brief. I'll start with what we agree on. You know, the point about the discount rate not mattering is absolutely correct. For what we view as the important questions in this space, pension sustainability, when and if plans are going to run out of assets, the discount rate is largely irrelevant. As a result, we do not spend any time on it, you know, analytically. And in fact, we think the past focus in the academic literature on the discount rate has been increasingly unproductive. So we very much agree. Okay. So a lot of the discussion of Bob and Josh's paper and the presentation today focuses on what they see as our failure to set the discount rate equal to the asset return rate, and both of these equal to the risk-free rate of return. However, we view the correct asset rate return of assumption for the public sector, as opposed to the private sector, as a very thorny and unsettled question, and I'll come back to this. But as a result, we present all of our results under three asset return assumptions, including the preferred, you know, for Josh and Bob, the risk-free rate of return. So if you, like Josh and Bob, want a risk-free rate of return on assets, everything we do is available to you in that framework. I will also say that all the key themes of our paper go through, you know, very much fully under the risk-free rate of return for assets. You know, one of the key things we're trying to do in the paper is show a sharp conceptual and practical difference between a stabilization strategy and a strategy of transitioning to full funding. And here, even under a risk-free asset rate of return, we find an enormous difference between a stabilization strategy and the contribution increase to get to full funding. And I just want to make sure that that's clear to everybody. And to us, this has pretty clear and simple intergenerational implications. Like Keith said, you know, moving to the full funding is going to impose burdens on the current generation that were accrued in the past. You know, I would also note that Bob and Josh referred to these liabilities as the sins of the past. That's a very normative term. We would prefer to simply view this as a form of government debt. Governments almost always take on debt, and it's often not problematic. Okay, so another key point of their paper is that some but not all of our asset return assumptions involve what they term arbitrage profits. They can view it that way. We instead just view this as governments deliberately and openly adopting a funding and budgeting strategy that involves risk. You know, governments are often the entities in society best positioned to take on such risks. They're infinitely lived. They have the power to tax. Furthermore, they're representing citizens that in many cases hold no equities and may benefit from exposure to risk. Most fundamentally of all, in our view, they need to be making decisions over pensions in the context of their full set of public policy responsibilities. This makes the correct funding decisions and how to budget for risk incredibly difficult. And there's actually very little literature on this. There's a very small literature at the federal level about how governments, not private entities, but governments should account for risk in budgeting. And it's very controversial and unsettled. There's almost nothing on this at the state and local level. More work needs to be done on this. And as a response to this, we think presenting a variety of asset return assumptions is just a very reasonable way to go. Okay, another criticism of our results are that they are all deterministic. This is a clear limitation of our approach. It was a deliberate limitation. We had a couple key points we want to make. These are most clearly made through the more simplistic deterministic approach. But, for instance, we've very much benefited and learned from Don and Yimeng's work using stochastic returns. Don has been pushing us to do that. And we very much want to do that. Look at sustainability with stochastic asset returns. We think that's going to be very interesting. We'd actually hope to do that today. But the COVID pandemic intervened and, you know, Louise decided, you know, I think wisely to go in a different direction. But we will have those results in the future. And there's all kinds of opportunities there. Once we have the stochastic results.
Thank you. Appreciate it. It's just a shortness of time here. We do have some questions coming in. And this is a question I'm sure you've been asked before. Everyone has a different angle on this large issue, balancing what you spend or what a government, state and local government, spends on their people, on their services, on their police, on maintaining infrastructure and so on, versus putting the money into the pension fund. I'm not going to ask whether you think about this or not, but how do you think about it? And who would like to respond, if at all?
I mean, I'll speak very quickly, which is that is our point of view on looking at the rate of return on assets. So it's very hard to know how you make those trade-offs. You made the trade-offs in the past in one particular way. When the rate of return on assets has fallen so dramatically, then you have to reconsider those kinds of trade-offs. And if what you're trying to do is look for the best future for your state or your city, then you want to ask yourself if having kids drinking leaded water or having, you know, no, only a bad online education is better for the future than having a little bit more pension debt. And that's the kind of trade-offs we try to make. If the internal rate of return that you can get from investing in your people is higher than the rate of return you can get on your pension assets in a risk-adjusted way, then that's how you should think about it.
Can I add to that?
Yes, please.
So I think that we agree with Louise and our co-authors that it's important to understand the trade-offs that exist. I think Byron mischaracterized our differences. I think our difference is how you look at risk and specifically how you characterize the PAYGO risk. I am perfectly comfortable with something that Keith recommended, which is to peel off the legacy debt, put that, amortize that over a longer time period and do layered amortization going forward. We're comfortable with that, but we can't look at risk and trade-offs in a purely deterministic world without dealing with the big elephant in the room, which is investment risk, which has driven the challenges that we face so far. You can't ignore that and say that we're looking at trade-offs. That is not an appropriate way to look at it, does not highlight the issues, and that's where our major difference is, not what the rate of return is. I'm fine with different rates of return. We don't think a risk-free rate of return on assets is right. That's simply not true. But we need to incorporate risks in our metrics of pension funding.
I'm going to actually take the moderator's privilege here. I'm sharing a screen that, oops, let's see if I can get this right. Am I sharing it? Can you see it? Okay. So I appreciate that Emeng is focused on eventually providing a document or a series of reports that are useful for public policymakers. I have used this chart numerous times when I speak to elected officials. So it's simplistic in some ways. It doesn't deal with interest rates, discount rates, and so on. It's Mr. Market, really, is what this is about. And it's just, again, I use this with elected officials to emphasize the importance of compounding in the whole pension discussion. And so going back to 93 and the end of the 90s, the green bars are the earnings on investments, and you can see the growth rate. And then you can see the collapse in 2000. And going forward with the volatility. This is, each bar is 100%. And so when we had the negative, the major asset losses in 01, 02, and again in 08, 09, we just artificially pushed the bar down to show the loss of investment. How do you make that up over time is something that would be great to see in some of these studies. I also want to just quickly point out that in 2000, many of the pension funds were fully funded. And then what happened? The one consistent thread that's been running through this is low, extraordinarily low interest rates. The risk-free rate dropped through the floor and has stayed there and is likely to continue staying there. And in a very simplistic way, which I tell the elected officials, 10% return on a dollar is a lot different than 10% return on $100. So I'm going to just close this out. We do have a couple of, Okay, we have a couple of questions for Tom Aaron, expectedly. And the question is, if a plan manager or a government decides to stop their contributions for 3 years, how might that affect them in terms of a downgrade? And then a counterpoint, I'm running a few questions together. How does the balancing act of reduced investment in infrastructure, reduced investment in the community play into a downgrade, potential downgrade?
So the answer is not quite as straightforward. If government X, you know, reduces its contribution by some amount, that automatically means, you know, Moody's changes a rating. It's really a matter of scale and magnitude that has to take into consideration, you know, all the pension risks that are involved. So meaning that the pension system cash flow the magnitude of the contribution change, the ramifications of that decision as we see it for the progression of that entity's balance sheet. And the other thing I'll just add is, I'm here talking just about pensions. There's a number of other things that go into credit ratings that are not pension related. So, of course, that has to get considered as well in totality. So it's not just a sole look at the pension contribution decision. So the other part of the question, Natalie, seemed to be, how do the other, expenditures and balancing between revenue expenditures sort of balanced against pension funding get put into consideration as part of a credit rating? And I think the short answer to that is service solvency. And where I think we have seen municipal bond, crises in terms of either defaults, bankruptcies, or near misses, ultimately it comes down to the capacity of the government to deliver and perform on its core service mission, while also servicing its other sort of must pay obligations like pensions and then bonds. And if service solvency, is really a critical issue and is challenged, I think our observation has been that that tends to produce very high levels of risk for bonds, and our methodologies really reflect that view.
Okay, we have 4 minutes. Open it up to panelists. Questions, comments?
So I have a question for the other panelists. So one of the things that people don't talk about a lot with this very low interest rate environment is that state and local workers now have this pension promise that is much more valuable than what private sector workers are getting when they basically all have DC plans and therefore have no protection. So like when we first did our stuff, we're like, why are they able to lower pension benefits? Isn't that just going to have to show up in wages? And the answer was, we don't think so, because what they're doing is paring some back. So is that something that people think about, talk about, recognize at the state level, that maybe if you're giving more now, something that's more valuable in pensions and more costly, that trade-off should happen? Or I'm just curious, maybe from Keith or...
Well, I'll tell you, if you look at the change in compensation, wages and salaries for employees of state and local government, they tend to be more volatile than the private sector. And when the economy tanks, then state and local government salaries do poorly also. And with certain exceptions, in general, employees of state and local government tend to be found to be paid less than their peers out with comparable levels of education and responsibility in the private sector.
Louise, that's a great point. If you look at what happened after the last recession, public workers got hit pretty hard. They got hit in terms of their pension. So new workers' benefits are much less valuable than older workers' benefits. They also got hurt in wages. Wages were flat or declined. And then employment was also down. So there are fewer people doing the job that they do. So their job conditions are harder. So I think it was a triple whammy. I think that you guys are right to highlight that we don't want that kind of triple whammy again. And we've got to find a way to manage through it. But public workers are taking a big hit in the recession.
Anybody else? Public workers have just, in the COVID era, have taken a huge hit. It's almost, on an unseasonably adjusted basis, close to 2 million layoffs or furloughs. Some may be hired back, but it's really unclear in very many sectors. So you have less contributions coming in from workers. That applies as well in the private sector and Social Security funding, Social Security and Medicare funding, in terms of the huge unemployment that we have. Anybody else want to take a whack at the pension pinata? One more minute. No takers?
I would simply reiterate what Josh said in response to Byron. We were not advocating contributions that are tied to the risk-free rate. We put forth the trade-offs between various contributions at now versus expected contributions later. Thank you.
Okay. I would go ahead and just respond to that we also, we have sympathy for the comment, you know, as I hope I made clear that, you know, more fully accounting for risk through some stochastic work would be a good addition to our work. And we think it will fit seamlessly within our sort of stabilization framework. I also didn't get a chance to say, I just wanted to thank Josh and Bob for engaging seriously with our work. Although we obviously have some points of disagreement, you know, these discussions are very productive. And I think what we've discussed today actually moves the discussion in the right direction and in a more productive way than it's often gone in the past. And that's fantastic.
Let me just add in that vein, it would be great if you guys shared the data.
Okay. We've been considering that. There's, yes. We'd be happy to talk with you about that.
Okay, final word. It's 11:45, and I want to deeply thank all of the panelists for presentations, comments, and all of the listeners out there. We do have another panel on climate change coming up in a minute or two, so please hang on, and we'll have the transition in a few seconds. So thank you again. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, all of you. So welcome, everybody. Yep. For the last panel of the day and something completely different. So we are now going to be talking about the effects of climate change on muni markets and on economic conditions more generally. We have three panelists that I'd like to introduce. David Victor is a professor of industrial organization and innovation at the School of Global Policy and Strategy at UC San Diego. He's also co-chair of the Brookings Institution's Initiative on Energy and Climate. Chris Hartshorn is Chief Commercial Officer at RISC. I'm not sure if you pronounce it RISC or RISQ, a firm that models the financial risk posed by climate change and translates them to actual insights for municipal debt stakeholders. Yes, I did get that from their website. Todd Metcalf is an economist at Moody's Analytics, where he works on a wide variety of research areas, including the municipal bond market and climate change. So what we're going to do is I've actually asked each of these panelists to start with some opening remarks. And then we'll have a discussion. And we're going to go in the following order. First, David, then Chris, and then Todd. So I'm going to give it over to you, David. Thanks. Yep.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. I just want to make sure my screen can be seen. Great. Thank you, Louise. So it's a pleasure to be with you. I just want to take 5 minutes and make some opening remarks about three topics, about the natural science of climate change, first, second, about the economics, what we know there, and third, what we're beginning to learn through a new study that we're hosting at the Brookings Institution about what the markets know about climate change risks. We're looking at equities, and we're also looking at municipal debt, so I'm going to focus my remarks today on what we think we're learning on the municipal side of things. So just in rapid fire, first, one of the most important things to learn from the climate science right now is that climate warming is accelerating. So this slide here is from a paper that a team of us published in Nature at the end of 2018. That was at the moment when the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change had just kind of issued dire warnings about how quickly we were going to pass 1.5 degrees of warming. So we went back and reanalyzed all the data using new climate models, and in particular took account of some evidence that the oceans are slowing down in their capacity to absorb heat, and also that ironically, when more countries control air pollution, that actually accelerates warming because in particular sulfate pollution makes clouds brighter and cools the planet a little bit. And so that masking effect was being released. And when you did that, what you see on the red line here is that warming is actually moving up much more rapidly and not at the linear pattern that was in the past. That means that the time which we're going to pass 1.5 degrees is maybe much earlier, maybe 2030, maybe even earlier than that. That's bad news if you live on the planet. I guess we all live on Zoom today, so maybe that doesn't bother us immediately. But it's interesting news if you're an analyst, because it means that a lot of the scenarios about climate impacts that used to be coming out of the climate models in the year 2050 and beyond, those scenarios are becoming more probable earlier. And that may be quite material to the municipal finance business and lots of other businesses. I want to make one point about the economics of climate change. There are lots of different ways that climate change is going to affect humans. It's going to affect nature as well. We often like to convert all that into dollars because we care ultimately about what the economic impacts are going to be. And investors should care about that as well. And a number of different groups are now doing this with quite a lot of sophistication. One group, I'm going to show data here from the Climate Impact Lab at Berkeley in Chicago and collaborating Rutgers and a few other institutions. We used this a year or so ago in a big study out of Brookings to look at the relationship between climate impacts and voting behavior. It turns out that people don't always vote rationally. I know that's shocking news. Almost perfect anti-correlation between places that are most exposed to climate impacts and the way they vote. So that was our interest a year or so ago. We're now using the same kind of information to look at the economic impacts of climate change and how they might affect different kinds of municipalities. And what this study does is it basically converts all the different impacts, you know, impacts of crops, floods, heat stress, worker productivity, coastal impacts from cyclonic storms and so on, converts them all into dollars. When you do that, what you see is that along the eastern seaboard, the coastal impacts are pretty significant. But overall in the country, the single most important thing to take away from this area of the economic science meets climate science is that heat stress, its impact on productivity and its impact on death, heat stress is what really drives the economic impacts. That's something that we in the municipal finance world should be paying attention to because it's going to affect tax bases and a variety of other things. The third and last thing I want to talk a little bit about is what do we see when we go off and look at issuances of municipal bonds, about what are people saying with regard to climate change impacts. Let me just say, this is I'm new to this area, and we're doing the same thing in equities. It turns out it's a lot easier to do it in equities. We can, over 5 days, look at all 3,000 of the largest traded equities for an entire decade at all their 10Ks and get it all done in 5 days with machine learning and a variety of other tools. It takes us a week to do a couple of hundred bond issuances, and Chris Hartshorn runs a terrific blog, and I sure can share stories about how difficult it is to kind of figure out exactly what the municipal finance industry knows about climate change, because we're working one bond at a time. And so any of you out there in the cyber sphere who have big data sets and an interest in talking publicly about what we actually see in these instruments, we are ready to collaborate because we are really struggling with this from a data perspective. This shows with states as the unit of analysis from a sample, and I can talk more in detail about the sampling, which bond issuances, what fraction of bond issuances up to 86%, fraction of state level bond issuances, or aggregate at the state level, say anything about climate change. There's a clear coastal effect. There's actually, we think, going to be a pretty significant political effect. It's not just the coasts are more exposed. It's actually they're also more blue. So they're saying more about climate change even when they're not as exposed as other places. And the last slide I want to show is an effort to look at this data in a very granular way. And what this shows is on the horizontal axis is the predicted income loss near the end of the century from that same study that I mentioned earlier, the Climate Impact Lab study. So this is county level resolution. The science is really advanced on high spatial resolution analysis of economic impacts. And then the vertical axis is reading bond by bond, which is always fun, the percentage of bonds that mention climate change at all. And what you see is a cloud of data. Essentially no relationship between, there's a little bit of relationship depending on how you look at the data, essentially no relationship between predicted income loss and mentions of climate change. Now, of course, this is predicted income loss, median loss in the later part of the century. But if you take seriously what I said earlier about how quickly the climate science is changing and accelerating, and in particular recognizing tail risks, then these are the kinds of things you'd at least think people would begin to be talking about. And you take just Johnson, Texas, which is one of the places that's mentioned right there, and you say, well, what does Johnson, Texas say about climate change risk? Here's what they say, sum total of what they say in their most recent general obligation bond, which is it's a phrase about economic impacts relating to domestic and international climate change. So I guess that's limited just to the planet. And it's in the context of hostilities, cybersecurity issues, and everything else, the kind of standard catch-all information. So I think it's really interesting. There's a company connected with Todd's shop, Chris Hartshorn's company, does more analysis in this area. There's a lot of analytical tools that are emerging that allow us to do a whole lot better in talking about climate change impacts than we are right now. But right now, the market knows, as far as I can tell, approximately nothing that is useful with regard to climate change exposure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, let's move right to Chris.
Hi, I'm going to go ahead and share my screen, and I will assume that everyone can hear me okay. And go ahead and present, and then I'll minimize that. Great. So David provided an excellent lead-in. I'm not going to go ahead and belabor the point on disclosure, although I could go on ad nauseum about the quality of climate risk disclosure. Since risk is probably a new name to most people, just the quick background is what we do, why we do it. So actually spun out of Northeastern University, there's a renowned sustainability and data science lab there. Does some excellent work. We're on a four-year journey, substantially funded by the NSF, that has landed us as our first application, our first market, in the municipal bond sector and the fixed income space broadly. And with some partners that I think some people in this conference will recognize, Tom, Lisa, Matt, and the team at MMA, we've been working with them for a good couple of years. And then ICE Data Services are a market partner of ours as well. We've gone to the trouble of doing full climate risk analysis for the entirety of the obligor issuer and CUSIP universe that represents the muni bond space. There are a couple of canonical constructs that we talk about, or that we can simplify down to at least. Obviously, there are many economic factors and exposures that we talk about, but the primary ones, property value at risk and GDP impairment risk, I guess the canonical variables that we can look at in the context of different stresses that are out there. And so if you take a look at any given issuer, any given obligor, so for example, Harris County, Texas, victim of Hurricane Harvey and other contemporary events, you can get into a breakout of property value at risk by time. And you can place Harris County on a percentile basis across the national cohort of all counties in terms of property value at risk to a given date. And you can do exactly the same thing from a GDP impairment risk basis and also see distributions within space as to whether GDP is impacted by different perils more so than property value. That obviously has interesting implications for how it flows through to different types of bond issuers and different types of revenue streams that underpin those bonds. The interesting part of this comes, and this is a couple of key points that I'll make going into the discussion. Interesting part of this comes when you start breaking down that type of risk. So the property value at risk and the percentiles that you can place each and every cohort and each and every geography in. So if we look at inland flooding alone on a percentile basis, we can actually break down individual cohorts. So looking at, for example, all the counties across the US in the context of the percentiles they fall in on an inland flood basis, inland flood risk basis to residential property, we can drop them into buckets. Those buckets of percentiles allow us to then do some really interesting things, such as take those percentiles and find correlations or correlations between what percentile a given county falls in terms of inland flood risk and what have been the realized changes in real estate value even over the last, 6 or 7 years. And you can see the worst 10 to 15% of counties in terms of inland flood risk have seen noticeable differences in terms of the real estate value change that's occurred over time. You can take the same data and you can also look at what's happened to net migration rates. Again, the worst 10 to 15% of counties on an inland flood basis have seen by far the largest changes in actual negative net migrations of population as a result of the inland flooding risk and the realization of that inland flooding risk. So there's a couple of components in here that I'll point out. First one is we all like to point to the Miamis of the world for hurricane risk. We all like to look at California because wildfire events are a front page New York Times event, right? But as it turns out, inland flood risk is probably the highest and most systemic contemporary risk to the underlying health of many issuers across the country and actually the lion's share of the issuer base that's out there. And the second key takeaway is we talk about these 2060, 2080, 2100 year reports and outlooks. Climate risk is already having meaningful impacts upon population and meaningful impacts upon real estate value which are two of the underlying fundamental health parameters that one has to look at when one's considering the health of an underlying issue. Okay, so we'll set that aside for a moment. Then we'll look at hurricanes, because why not? The other takeaway I'll give you is it's easy to talk about states and sort of the high-level issuers and the headliners, right? It's easy to talk about counties as well, which I've already done in terms of inland flood. But there are meaningful risks to different types of issues out there. As everyone on this in this conference knows, we're not just talking about municipalities when we talk about municipal bonds. Hospitals are issuers of debt, and hospitals suffer significant revenue impairment from these events as well. So it's important to take all of this in context and look at the types of impairment events and the types of first payment default data that's out there. And this is taken from our friends at MMA, borrowed with pride, from around the start of this year. This is looking at a rank order of the different types of issuers and the first time payment defaults that are experienced. You can see that the GO issuers that most talk about are not at the top of this list. It's CCR, it's retirement communities, so CCRCs, it's housing, it's charter schools, it's hospitals. These revenue bond issuers are substantially at risk from climate events because they're already substantially more impaired on a percentage basis. So if we look, we've already talked about hospitals a little bit, but we can also talk about land secured. A couple more examples on hospitals. Hurricane Harvey took the Care Regional Medical Center into bankruptcy down in Corpus Christi. A hospital with exactly the same percentile risk in terms of overall climate risk, it sits in the 97th percentile out of all 7,500 hospitals that we've analyzed that bring debt into the market. So it's in exactly the same approximate space with exactly the same risk. And yet, if you go and look at disclosures, if you go and look at risk mitigation, if you go and look at any of these things associated with these types of issuers, you're not going to find a whole lot, but I guarantee the risk is there, as Care Regional will tell you. And then the last component in here is the level of geospatial specificity that you've got to bring when understanding all of these issuers. It's not, if you understand Harris County overall, that is certainly interesting and valuable if you're analyzing Harris County specifically. But when you get into land deals, dirt deals, so all the muds across Harris County, you can see the 100-year inland flood risk, the 500-year inland flood risk, the hurricane flood risk. There is a wide distribution of risks across the muds that fall within the boundaries of Harris County. And when you go and look at the yields, the coupons, all of the underlying financial risk metrics and where you would expect risk to be taken into account, you're not going to see are more likely to come from the impaired classes from the MMA data. So there's a lot to chew on in there, but it's basically the risks are contemporary and now. It's not just hurricane and it's not just wildfire, it's also inland flooding. But it's also some of the smaller issuers that we have to worry about in that context. Just so anyone's wondering, 2020's not setting up terribly well for those in the climate risk game. So expect a heightened hurricane season for this year. Expect a heightened wildfire season, well above historical averages for this year. And your inland flooding risk is going to be higher this year as well. And I'm sure I'm belaboring a point that's already been hammered over the last day and a half. Where the entire municipal market is already under a little bit of stress, it's fair to say, and financially, logistically, and temporally is probably in as bad a position as it can be to handle some of the stresses that are going to come in the second half of this year from a climate perspective. With that, I will pass it to over to the panel.
Yes, Todd.
How do you follow that?
Something more optimistic.
Well, I'm not sure how optimistic I will be, but so far we've been focusing, especially with David, on kind of the disclosures, with Chris on a lot of the specific kind of low-level impact. And kind of the holy grail is what is the physical risk? What's the cost of that? What's the likelihood of it occurring? How much does it cost to mitigate? And then what's the difference? And that's an important part of the equation. But we looked at the other side, and that was what's the creditworthiness of places going to be able to pay for damages? And how is that going to then impact their ability to adapt? Not surprisingly, population changes can impact creditworthiness of bond issuers. I'm going to do a quick disclosure. So as was mentioned, I'm Moody's Analytics. I do not rate bonds. We do the economic forecasting for Moody's, and we do a lot of our credit risk models. So I work on our credit risk municipal bond model. And so MIS actually, Moody's Investor Services puts out an annual default study. And population change has been one of the big things that it shows up in some of our defaults. As Chris mentioned, hospitals are actually one of the ones where that has occurred a few times where population changes have really impacted the default. But it's also shown up in local governments, the two big examples being Detroit and Puerto Rico. Now, according to Moody's, at least, Chris might disagree with us, there has not been a default directly due to natural disasters. There have been downgrades. So the big examples there would be New Orleans following Hurricane Katrina, which was a large population hit, and that was a very large part of that. But then also Paradise, which is currently rated as a junk bond following the campfire, but as of now, it has not defaulted. So the thing where I think this is important is, and I'm going to share my screen real quick, is looking at what the overall headwinds are going to be from a population standpoint. And so what we see is this is the 30-year change in creditworthiness. So we took the 30 years preceding, so 1990 to 2020, and predicted what that population change would say that our metro areas would be rated today. And then we took the 30-year baseline population and we projected that out to 2050 and looked at where we would be. And I think this is one of those... unfortunately, this is not optimistic. It shows that in general, we're going to be less credit worthy just because of population. This is before COVID stress. This is before pensions. This is before anything else. And so it's not climate, but I think it's important because it helps to set up where we're going to be able to pay for it. Now, we use the EPA's ICLS model. Under the HAGM climate model, which basically redistributes population based on summer and winter temperature and precipitation. And so the idea is that people are going to move to nicer climates. And using that model, what we found was that it's obviously going to change the population distribution. And so what we actually see on that, now it's not necessarily all good news. We see the South Central increasing slightly and the Midwest increasing slightly under that model. But of course, it's slightly better than the baseline, which still shows a decline. Now, so that's one of the important things to consider. But then we also see the stress in the West and on the East Coast. And so we know that basically there's going to be extra impairment in those areas.
So is the first part without thinking about environmental changes and the second one with? I just want to clarify.
Correct. So the first one, so this is our baseline. This is just our baseline 30-year forecast. And then the second one is just under the 4.5. And I use this as kind of the representative. Under 8.5, it's qualitatively similar. There are some places that change just because of just how the pattern changes overall. And then taking it out to 2100, they're qualitatively similar. Each one will kind of show slight differences, but they're more or less the same.
Okay.
Not a problem. And so the big thing though for this is there's a model I want to say came out in February where they showed climate or population changes under sea level rise. And so I think they would disagree with us on Florida. And there's going to be differences, but I think the big points here is that we're already going to be weak and a lot of areas that are going to have problems paying for adaptation, these problems are going to be exacerbated. So unfortunately, as I said, I was not as optimistic as you may have hoped.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, so we have about 15 minutes, 17 minutes for questions. So if viewers want to write in, and just a reminder for the last time, that you can submit questions at emailing events@brookings.edu or by joining the conversation on Twitter using hashtag MuniFinance. But let me talk a little bit about what I heard. So I actually heard sort of three different focuses in terms of the bad impacts from climate change. David, you talked about heat stress and the effects on health and productivity. Chris, you talked about inland flooding, and Todd, you talked about population. When we think about those, are they do three of you disagree about the most important things, or is it that you're looking at it from different perspectives? Anybody? Yeah, David.
I think it depends on what your goal is. So and the list goes on from there. You know,
yeah.
You want to have optimism. Don't have a panel on climate change, but So there are, for example, big impacts on crops, although the impacts are mixed because in some places growing seasons get longer. Some plants actually grow better with a little more CO2 in the atmosphere. Others on the margins are harmed. And so when you put all that together, if you look at the overall economic impacts of the country, it's no question that the overall economic impacts, when you start killing large numbers of people, significant numbers of people, and hurting productivity, for which there's now a lot of empirical evidence that the economic drain of that is substantial. In some places, the coastal impacts are dominant. But I just want to underscore something that Chris said, which I think is very important for understanding the intuition from the climate science that matters for the municipal finance world. The high-profile activities where a hurricane or a tornado wipes something out and then people come in and rebuild, the economic impact of that sometimes is actually neutral or positive. We don't like to talk about it that way. But in terms of local community, but it's these persistent events. It's inland flooding that drives people away. I think the heat stress story is going to turn out to be very important. You know, some places in the world where heat stress is high, Qatar, and they air condition the outdoors. Well, not everybody can do that. And so instead, what we're going to do in this country is people are going to move. And so you're going to have a few areas where these climate impacts, wildfires, an example of that, where the systemic impacts are going to be migration, erosion of tax bases, and so on. I think that's the thing to really watch.
Yeah. No, I'd agree with that. I'm not sure.
Oh, I'm sorry. We can
David.
Can you say it again? We lost for a minute.
Yeah. So my take on things is not different than David's or Todd's. I think it's in some ways it's additive. So we totally agree that drought's and heat stress are going to be significant problems. We absolutely agree. In fact, we've got data to suggest that population is a meaningful metric to watch migrate over time. Excuse the pun. We just think there are probably some nearer term risks and some contemporary risks that need to be looked at right now. And to David's point, we think that a lot of them are underpinned by bad fundamentals in terms of P&C insurance, where in the past there's been substantial insurance coverage, and then with not insurance coverage, there's been FEMA coverage. P&C insurance is backing out of the high-risk areas, and I wouldn't look at the balance sheet of FEMA as being particularly robust right now and no more robust in the future. So I would take in all of the above, not to be Debbie Downer or Donald Downer, depending on what your flavor of Downer is. I think I'm an all-flavored Downer. So all of the above for my answer.
So you brought me to one of the questions I wanted to ask, which is about this, the FEMA put. So you're looking at current FEMA conditions, but we're talking about, looking 50 years ahead. And also just more generally, you know, small things might be FEMA, but if you have a huge area that is really is struggling, you can imagine some other kind of too big to fail thing coming in. So when you think about whether or not these risks are priced into bonds right now, do you think, first of all, if they are, and if they're not, how much of it is because people believe that somehow the federal government will protect against the biggest tail risks? Or, I mean, David, you said that you didn't see them mentioned in the bond prospectus, but do we think that they're priced indirectly or indirectly through what's already happened?
I think it's just starting to really be thought of. I mean, the Moody's Investor Services, the ratings agency, has been, so David mentioned one of the companies that they just bought was 427, and that was to be able to understand the risk better. There was a Urban Institute study, I guess, out last year where basically they mentioned that once the credit rating agencies actually decide that they're going to be pricing it in, that's when it will truly be priced in. Because the market will have to do it. CRE is starting to price it in now because that 30 years horizon, now I guess Chris would argue that it's already being seen, but that 30 year horizon is kind of where I think most people are seeing the most risk being. And that's starting to get to our financial horizon where, okay, we need to price that in. But a lot of the risk are 100 years out, and that's really difficult to price in. But though insurance companies obviously still need to be concerned about that. But it's complex, and you know, it goes back to kind of that first question. There's so many parts and so many moving parts, and you know, some areas are going to benefit and some areas won't, and where you'll actually see that's going to be difficult to tell long term. And so it's I think it's going to be a rolling, we're just going to get better at it.
Yeah, and if I could just comment on that, just two things very briefly. I agree, it's complex, life's hard, and so on, but we now have skills to allow us to analyze this with a coefficient that's not zero. And that's what these companies are about and the science is about and so on. To me, what's really striking about the climate impacts work is how the uncertainties have gone up. So we tend in the climate science world to be talking about how much we know, and we want to make sure everyone knows we know what we're talking about and so on. And sure, that's true to some degree. But a lot of these impacts are tail risks, and they're interactive tail risks. And so the science has actually moved in the direction of understanding the full breadth of outcomes. And you see this in interesting things like the range of possible sea level rises reported by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has doubled over the last two assessments. California, when they updated their sea level rise guidance from 2015 to 2018, which is the last big update, they literally doubled for the year 2050, not, you know, in the year 2300 and so on, but the year 2050, they doubled. They didn't assign probabilities and they did some other wacky things, but hey, it's California. But they doubled the high-end estimate, almost doubled the high-end estimate. And so this is really, I think this is what is we're now seeing. And the point about whether the markets are pricing this differently, we're just finishing a big review paper and an analytical paper. The slide that I showed, a couple slides I showed today are the results that are literally a week old from that paper that we're working on. But as part of it, we did a big lit review. There is a couple of peer-reviewed papers that suggest using extremely large samples that the markets, exactly as Todd said, are beginning to price it in a very, very minor way, in particular around sea level rise and some things about real estate value. But the signal is really hard to see, and you need a gigantic sample for it.
And Todd, you mentioned something interesting, which whether if you can sort of write a model where you say, if you do nothing, here's what the costs are. That's one way of evaluating the cost. But you also mentioned there's like, well, maybe it's the mitigation costs. And so, you know, is anybody trying to sort of to do that as opposed to when you think about what it's going to cost state and local governments?
Not that I'm aware of, but I think part of that is because until you can tell it's hard to tell whether you should mitigate or how much you should spend to mitigate until you know how much it's going to cost you. Because if the mitigation costs more than the damage, you take the damage. Mm-hmm. So I think it's, unfortunately, I think it's still being priced. I mean, there's sea level or a seawall is being talked about being built in Miami by the Army Corps of Engineers. And so we're starting to price mitigation, but I don't think there's anything really comprehensive on that, at least not that I'm aware of.
Yeah, nothing comprehensive. We've seen a couple of the very leading high profile areas of the country. So Miami Beach did a really good study looking at the cost of mitigation and the benefit of mitigation, but it's on very case by case basis, and certainly nowhere near across the broad spectrum of 55,000 some odd issuers, right? So it's the early adopters are starting to think about this, and only the ones of a sort of the front page. Everyone talks about Miami, so Miami's doing it, right?
Yeah,
and it's going to really change the way we do the analysis, because we often analyze things at risk. But the moment you start hardening the assets, then you really need to understand the damage function, like power pole by power pole and bridge by bridge. And that's the frontier of the engineering science right now.
So, Chris, you sort of looked at this all sort of from the perspective of the municipal bond market, and you too, Todd, obviously, which do we think, so I sort of think of it on two ends. One, that's the first place we're going to start seeing that it matters and maybe be a public policy signal that people should be, you know, policymakers should be doing something about it. But then I also wonder whether or not that lens is the public policy lens. As you mentioned, like, you don't worry about general obligation bonds. We worry about hospitals because they might go bankrupt. But when we think about, you know, the deaths that David mentioned, is that going to be reflected? So how do you think about that? I know you said you're funded by the NSF, so you have a public mission. How do you think about that?
Well, we're no longer funded by the NSF, so our public mission to become an entrepreneurial mission, as you're quite clear. But no, to your point, there is an interesting disconnect between public policy that is municipalities, that is the state, that is the federal level, versus the public policy that impacts the revenue lines of the underlying service providers that nonetheless put debt out into the municipal market, right? So, and it's actually where we see the greatest gap in knowledge as well as the greatest gap in responsibility. You really see climate risk disclosed in revenue bonds, and particularly the non-city, non-state, non-federal level bonds, because the knowledge isn't there, the expertise isn't there, the ability to do anything about it isn't there. And therefore, well, what's to talk about if you don't know and you can't tell and there's nothing you can do? Then, okay, let's just be silent. So it is going to fall back, I think, from almost like a social perspective onto public policy to think about the underlying services that nonetheless put debt out into market through different instruments, even though that's through the municipal bond market. It's an interesting dichotomy one could point to that has to be solved for.
Anybody else?
Yeah, I agree with that. This is not the only area where there are very big public policy issues, and the exposure on real estate is pretty substantial. And I think, you know, there's a lot of implications of what we're all trying to get our hands around, which has to do with better disclosure and information in the market so the markets can respond. And then we ideally want to be able to see what that response is. We also need to work much harder on the FEMA and other puts, the flood insurance, the way even flood insurance is computed. There's a kind of a lot of crazy stuff going on there. And this backward focused analysis of perils when climate is a different future is really inappropriate. So there's all these areas where we could do some more, we have to do some more work to get the markets to function better and where the policy is creating these really big market failures.
So we got a question from the audience. So do panelists anticipate that COVID-19's public health and economic impacts will direct attention and funding away from climate adaptation at the local level? And so how do we think about that? Like, you know, were we starting to focus on it and now we've just got completely, off track because now we have another crisis that's near term to worry about? Or are they related at all? Or how do you think about that?
So it depends on your theory of change. So Elka Weber at Princeton, among others, has advances a kind of fixed pool of worry theory from cognitive psychology, which is people have a pool of things they worry about. And right now, COVID is filling up the pool. And so there's less time for climate change. And there's substantial evidence, in particular around the stimulus spending programs, that that's true. If you compare the stimulus spending programs and the amount of money, for example, that were devoted to clean energy in the last 2009, it was upwards of 15%, depending on how you count. This time around, much, much less. And of course, you got all these municipalities that are feeling, nobody's feeling rich right now. So they're not scrambling to go build a seawall, you know, whether or not it's a good idea. So I think overall the impact, especially in this country, the impact has been negative. The situation in Europe's a little bit different because of the way politics are organized around green issues, but we don't live in Europe.
Well, and I think that's also the quick important point is capability, I think, is to be able to even start thinking about this as being diminished at the state and local level. And unless there's the extra stimulus to bail them out, it's going to stay impaired for a while. So.
And what's happened at the federal level in terms of capability to think about these questions?
I think it's been willfully denied.
Gosh. Yeah, well, there was actually an interesting report that came out from the GAO today, talking about the changes in climate change assumptions that occurred with the change in administration. And ultimately, they began to use different boundary conditions, different assumptions, and different metrics to optimize to, and basically ended up with a climate change scenario that was at best 7 times lower than what the previous administration put into place. So flow that through the likely funding mechanisms and for the likely purviews of federal through state down to city. I think that's pretty clear. And supposedly the GAO is still a nonpartisan organization. Tell me something that's nonpartisan these days and I'll say you're a bridge.
Yeah, you asked for optimism. If I can offer any optimism, it's that there are two federal governments, right? There's the federal government that Jared, I gather, runs. And that's government is messing around and doing all kinds of crazy things with regard to science and facts and 2 + 2 = 97 and all kinds of stuff like that. And then you've got the professional government, the subject of Michael Lewis's last book, Fabulous Book. And that part of the government is under stress. There's no question about it. But they're still there, and NOAA is still there, and NASA is still there, and the NSF is still there, and you have to change what you say in an application for science about, for funding about climate change. But the capabilities that are there, and so I think, that part of the government capability has not taken as much of a hit as the more visible parts of government capability. So if you want some optimism, maybe that's it.
So I would say real quick, the other problem with the first part of the government is that they're also kind of impairing the information from the more optimistic in this regard part of the government. And that's creating issues where it's harder to actually price in some of these considerations. And they might see the light of day eventually, but they've been delayed. There was a USDA report that I think was delayed about a year before it was finally released on how climate change would impact it. So they're definitely slowing things down at the least.
Okay, well, on that cheery note, we are going to end this panel and end the conference. So I thank each of you for a really interesting discussion. Obviously, this is a topic we will be returning to for, many, many years. So hope to see you again another time at our conference. I want to thank everybody at Brookings who made this online conference doable and pretty seamless. So Anna Dawson, Howen Chen, and Steffi Sensula, as well as all the paper authors and panelists. And, I hope everybody's enjoyed the conference and learned a lot. And I hope to see you all in person at Brookings next summer. Zoom is fine, but in person is better. But anyhow, thank you, everybody, have a great day. Bye.